seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Okay, Golf Weekly fans, you're very welcome along. It's our post-US PGA review. We are very excited. We have, if I do say so, an unbelievable lineup. There is no golf pod even on the planet that has a better lineup than we're bringing you this afternoon. And by that I mean Fionn Davenport. Hello, Fionn.
Good afternoon.
No Nathan Murphy today. He's otherwise engaged. Myself and Fionn are going to take you through for the next 20-25 minutes. We're going to reflect on the US PGA. And then... And some of these may have appeared on Off the Ball already this week, so don't tweet us about your unhappiness with that. We're including them on the podcast, but there is bonus material coming, don't worry. We will bring you Paul McGinley. You may have noticed he wasn't on television over the weekend. Paul McGinley is on the way. We will bring you Shane Lowry, who's at the Wyndham Championship this week, really trying to save his USPGA card. And the exclusive, Fionn, the Golf Weekly friend of the pod exclusive, is only Claude Harmon III, coach to Brooks Koepka, part of the Harmon dynasty. Yeah. He's coming up very shortly. We're going to talk to him about Brooks Koepka, about Dustin Johnson. Going to pick a bone with him about Dustin Johnson. So, I mean, we're stacked. We're stacked full.
Nice. The Harmons really are quite the figure in golf, aren't they? Claude, senior, junior, the second, the third, a lot of them.
You recently pointed out to me, as in half an hour ago, who Claude the Second was, and I didn't realise.
Yeah, Butch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't either, by the way. Like, it's such an obvious thing. Like, his given name isn't Butch.
I just thought his name was Butch.
I know. But, it's Claude Harmon the Second.
Okay.
And, yeah.
We'll ask Claude the Third about that. Why didn't Claude the Third get a nickname? I'll get you some tweets, firstly. John O'Driscoll, like a lot of people, saying, what a final round in the PGA. Shame about the coverage, but has to be one of the best leaderboards of any major in recent times. Hashtag Woods, G-O-A-T. That's what the kids say for greatest of all time, Fionn, just in case that confused you on social media. And Koepka is a beast.
Even more confusingly is they don't even write G-O-A-T, they just have a goat emoji.
Yeah. John Quinn enjoyed the Damien McGrain. Did you listen back to this Damien McGrain last week at Carlo? It's pretty good.
No, okay. I saw it on my podcast feed and I went, well, I'm not on that podcast, so I'm not going to listen.
I understand. He said, cracking listen, some really interesting insight from Peter and Damien, hashtag friend of the pod. It is, if you haven't listened to it, I mean, it's billed as a USPGA preview, but really we spend about 30 seconds literally talking about the USPGA. So it's kind of a timeless piece. Derek Larkin has an interesting stat, Fionn. He says on Tiger Woods... And to be fair, this may be true of lots of golfers, but especially true in Woods' case because he hasn't played that many events. He says, if Tiger Woods' world ranking points were divided by the actual number of events he has played in the last 2 years, which is 18, he says, instead of the minimum divisor of 40, oh, I suppose that's the minimum divisor. So actually it applies more to Woods than most. Instead of the minimum divisor of 40, he wouldn't be ranked 26th in the world. Based on his form, he would be ranked number 4.
Which
sounds about right. I mean, Woods has basically contended in every tournament this year he's played in,
yeah,
basically.
Pretty much. Yeah, well, he's had more top fives than his game suggests he would be entitled to.
Yeah.
Or some of his play until this last week. But yeah, no, absolutely. He's had an amazing year.
Yeah. Mark Mullooly, great name. Mullooly is a great name. He says, refreshingly honest from Damien McGrain this week, for 80-85% of the tour, golf is only ever going to be a vocation and they won't see many wins, if any. How many of them would acknowledge that, I wonder, even behind closed doors? Damien McGrain effectively said, Fionn, that he doesn't love golf and he never really loved it. He just happened to develop a game and it kept taking him onto another level and then it was about making money. Now, he loved competing. He loved the adrenaline buzz. He loved... being in the mix, fighting for his card sometimes. But I mean, he got no pleasure from a crisply struck 7-iron as such. You know, he wasn't fascinated by the swing in a Harrington kind of way. That was all just a very, very uninteresting means to an end.
The first person I ever heard say that was Monty in the 90s, where when Monty was winning one European Order of Merit after another, And he was refreshingly honest back then. He had a candor that was both kind of affecting and almost charming. He was very funny. He's a very smart guy. And he made this declaration. I can't remember what event it was, but afterwards where he said, look, I'm not a particularly big fan of golf. I don't even like the game that much. I just happen to be very good at it. Yeah. And it's my job. Now, he didn't take away, he didn't detract from the effort involved or from the fans' enjoyment of good play or any of those things. I think he was just stating a fact. Mm. And the way he stated it suggested that he certainly wasn't alone, that this was much more the case with a lot of golfers. It's just that they just don't say it. And now, well, Brooks Koepka, obviously being maybe in recent times the most famous person to declare that he's not that big of a fan of golf. But yeah, so I and I also, as well as that, you and I, we yearn for the crisply struck shot and it delights us. But like the pro that was going, well, there's my mortgage payment, or, you know, that's my down payment on the car. It's a whole different thing, isn't
it? Yeah, I suppose it is. Nick Reynolds, one of a few people in touch, wondering what's the story with the podcast feed. Twitter feed has links to the USPGA special on the website, but no mention of it on the News Talk app or iTunes. Yes, there was an issue. We're not sure what it was. We were trying for, I mean, all day Thursday, all day Friday, we were trying to sort it out, and we couldn't until the last few days. So that's why we've renamed our USPGA special the Damien McGrain interview, which kind of lives up to its billing. So that's, we want to encourage people who might see USPGA preview now and not go for it. So you should still listen to it. Pro V1 Kenobi is hoping for a PGA pod so we can find out what happened after I threw my laptop at the telly. Hashtag pure sport. Hashtag pure shit. Hashtag pure sport was their hashtag. Why? It's the worst hashtag for the golf tournament of all time. I mean, 11 sports were like, tweet us about the golf. Hashtag pure sport.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Do you know what, though? Can I, I'm going to be the unpopular opinion. I actually, I think it's a really good thing that 11 sports had the PGA. Do you want to know why? Mm-hmm. It's much more democratic. So you can buy a package. You can buy, you can just watch the event for whatever it is, a five or whatever it was. Whereas on Sky, you need a full subscription. On BT Sports, you need a full subscription. Now, given that the days of free to air is over, so we'll just take that as a given. 11 Sports just struck me as a much more, now, sorry, it struck me as a much more democratic way to enjoy the golf. Now, the coverage of it wasn't particularly good, and poor old Jamie and the other lads stuck in that porta cabin.
Yeah,
Dominic doing a, like, you know, obviously they're going to have to really up their game in terms of not just coverage, but also all the side shows like that Sky Sports have really kind of set the bar on. Mm. But I like the idea that you can just download the app into your phone, you pay your fiver, and then you can watch the tournament. And I thought that that's much better than having to pay a year-long subscription to a sports channel.
That's a fair enough point, yeah. I mean, the coverage was obviously fairly poor, you know.
Kind
of, and it does take away, it does detract from the sense of event. That was the big issue for me. And
like
the segues in and out of the US commentary feed at times were just so clunky and messy. You can kind of live with that to a point. And I mean, why was the studio so bad was one thing I was just curious about. I mean, like, just you're in London, just rent a studio space for 2 days.
Yeah, because I agree.
It struck me that this was like almost their debut, you know. A lot of people were seeing 11 Sports for the first and last time, and they're looking for about 50 quid a month to get all your La Liga and Serie A, and who knows,
they 50 quid a year.
A year, sorry, yes, a year. I meant to say that, yeah.
Yeah.
They're only looking for 50 a year, comparatively speaking, very, very cheap. So I kind of decided early on, well, I'm not going near this because it's just, the production values are just so kind of terrible. Whereas actually, if they were clever, they should have really made a bit more of an effort for the golf. And then I think a proportion of people would have said, you know what, 50 quid a year, Ronaldo is at Juventus, I like watching El Clasico, I'll watch a few other games, 50 quid a year, go on then, I might just, what the hell, I won't even miss it. Whereas I think a lot of people like me were like, I'm getting out of here.
I'm one of those people that paid the 50 quid.
Oh.
Because I like watching La Liga and I want to see Ronaldo at Juventus. And I will mourn the production qualities, which I don't think, with all the best will in the world, I just don't think 11 Sports will have the skill, the experience, or the manpower to up their game to even rival Sky Sports in terms of slick quality. No. But at the same time, like, as much as I agree everything you've said, I thought that the segues were clunky. I also felt that I could have done without listening to Jamie or Dominic at all. Or maybe actually I didn't mind Jamie as much. But I would have liked to just listen to Nick Faldo more or just stick with the American commentary. So leaving all that aside, I just love the idea that I can stream it on my phone. I can... The one thing that kind of annoys me is that, well, I've got to figure, this is more my own issue, is I've got to figure out a way of how to stream 11 sports onto my TV.
Yeah, they don't do Chromecast. That's unforgivable.
It is unforgivable. And I'm assuming that if they've got all of this sweet, sweet sport lined up for the coming season, that they're going to address these issues because customers will just complain.
Well, they've been saying, I was looking on Twitter responses, they were saying, we're going to sort out the Chromecast thing soon. But they've been saying this for a number of months now. So.
Oh, have they?
Yeah.
Well, I'd never heard of them until last week.
Yeah, you and the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So Ken Bipe makes the point, if Tiger could borrow Koepka's tee shots, he'd be a double major winner this year, Open and PGA. Yeah, it's a point we'll come back to. Ken Bipe adds, Koepka, everything Dustin Johnson wishes he could be. Ouch.
That's a good point as well.
We've Claude Harmon coming up. I don't think I'll put it in quite those terms to Claude, but... I take the point.
Why is one of your guys so shit and the other guy so good?
Yeah, I know. Donal says, okay, interesting point. I got a bit of this on Twitter, I have to say. I find the cheerleading for Tiger on Golf Weekly, and he was replying to a tweet I put out about just how great it was Tiger was doing well on a Sunday. He says, I find it sickening. A lot of people not really able to get past the moral quandary of supporting Tiger, which I understand.
What's the moral quandary?
Well, his behaviour off the course is fairly reprehensible. What? And, you know, hasn't been a nice man. You read the book. We've talked about the book a good bit, probably too much on the show.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of people going, well, live and let live, but why are we cheering this guy on so much? I understand that. I wrestle with that myself.
I don't wrestle with it. I understand it.
You're a worse class of person than me, though.
No, absolutely. I'm a degenerate. There is absolutely... No, because... Tiger, is he a reprehensible human being? He certainly has behaved reprehensibly. I couldn't care less about his marriage woes. That is irrelevant to me. It is not our bailiwick to judge the actions of another person in relation to their relationships.
Yeah, agree.
He didn't, human beings are weak and frail, and that's just the way it is. But the reason why we cheer is the same reason why the crowd goes insane at Bellerive, is because he is, whether we like it or not, the single most exciting thing that the game of golf has. And, I can't get excited about anybody else, even my beloved Jordan Spieth, in the same way as I do about Tiger.
No, it's true. Sheelan Strain didn't love the coverage either. Thank God we got to see Griot's bogey put on the last there. Wouldn't have slept tonight without it. And we didn't see much Shane Lowry, I think, was the point they were making.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that was painful.
The only time we saw Shane Lowry was when he was holding up Purgis and Thomas on the 16th.
That's right.
The big issue.
But he was like, at one point they showed this crappy bogey putt by Jason Day. Or no, Jason Day was going for birdie, missed it. But he was at 8 under. Meanwhile, Shane Lowry's at 10 under.
Yeah.
Now motoring along. Now he obviously had a poor finish at the very end. But I mean, he was in contention.
Yeah, no, he had birdies.
He'd birdies
on 12 and 13. There was a really long putt on one of them. They showed the long putt, but I mean, you didn't see any of his two birdie holes on 12 and 13,
no,
where he's right in the teeth of the championship. It was very poor in that respect.
And that's not 11 Sports' fault. That's CBS Sports' fault.
No, because I was curious. I'd love to find out, and someone might know, if Sky were there, would they have better access to different feeds? As in, 11 Sports just literally take exactly what they're given. It's a straight diet from the feed they're taking. I wonder if Sky get, the straight tournament feed, and then also on a few different channels coming into them, are they getting extras? Are they getting, well, here is Justin Rose's shot in case you want to put that into your coverage and have your commentary team talk over it. And I suspect that does happen because it's been the most poorly served, of all the majors in a while, where we just didn't see much, particularly players we'd be interested in. So I do suspect if it was Sky, they'd have been able to access one way or another the Shane Lowry shots and then show them to their commentary team, who would have talked over them as any commentator does. So
yeah, that's a good point.
You know, that was the one gripe. That is probably one of the bigger downsides with 11 Sports, you know, that you could literally have Shane Lowry finishing fifth as he was on course to do, and we saw zero.
Now, interestingly enough, and I think the tweeter's point is very well warranted. However, 11 Sports are but a kind of an extreme and slightly clunky example of a trend that's been well established over the last 10 years, whether it's Sky Sports or whoever it is that's showing the golf. Even, like, they don't show that many players. And even when they do, they don't show all of the shots. So you don't get the full picture of a round of golf of the top 30 players at all anymore. And you used to. Yeah. A lot more than you do now.
No, it's true. Time is against us, so we're going to move on and talk about the tournament. We finished up. Sometimes you forget to look at the leaderboard sometimes at the end. Brooks Koepka, 16 under. Outright second, Tiger Woods on 14 under. Final round 64, his best ever. I found that was the most amazing stat of everything, that he shot his best ever major Sunday round. He's never beaten 65 before.
And his lowest score to par, or to shots, whatever it was, 264 shots of any major he's ever played in.
Okay, yeah. 266 to be exact, but I take your point.
266, sorry. 269 was what he won the Masters in 1997.
Right, okay. So,
but also par was 70 here, so.
Yeah, true. Woods, 14 under, outright second. Adam Scott in the end was outright third on 13 under. And then we had Stuart Sink. Amazing to see Stuart Sink back kind of out of nowhere. Yeah. Stuart Sink and John Rahm, 11 under. And then you have a bunch of guys on 10. Molinari, Peters, Justin Thomas, Gary Woodland. And then bum, 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 all the way down. Shane Lowry tied for 12th on 8 under. In the end, 8 shots off the lead. So, I mean, look, we don't have that much time here. And it's so disrespectful to not talk about Koepka. You know, and like everything, I just want to jump straight to Tiger. And it's so disrespectful. He's won 3 of his 4 wins in the PGA Tour or majors. He has had 4 top 10 finishes in majors since 2014. He's won 3 in the space of 14 months. Of the last 6 majors he's played, he's won 3 of them. Like, this is off the charts kind of stuff from Koepka.
It is.
The massive question is this like a Padraig Harrington-esque beautiful period that will dissipate for some reason? Or is this guy going to emerge as the post-Tiger generation's guy with most majors? Right now it feels like he might.
Okay, so on 17, and not just with Tiger lurking away in the background, it's the palpable energy of the crowd that even though Tiger is, whatever, a hole and a half ahead of him, you've got this palpable energy that's resonating throughout the course. And every time Tiger does anything that's interesting or good or accomplished, you hear this massive roar. So Koepka's got this going the whole while. On 17, he rips a drive down the middle of the fairway. Adam Scott goes left, doesn't he? And to me, so that's the great signifier. I think the tweeter who said earlier on, if Tiger Woods had Brooks Koepka's drives, he'd be a multiple major winner this year. But so
Tiger, by the way, didn't hit a fairway until 10. It was the most extraordinary front nine. How he's 3 under in that front nine, I've never seen it. It was a miracle.
But he did actually hit the shot of the tournament for me, but I'll get to it in a second. But it's Koepka's putter that did it. Really, if you look at the putts he sank, I mean, it's the irons he played into, but he just drained putt after putt after putt after putt. Now, he had 2 bogeys in a row, and then a couple of holes later went on a little birdie.
He did 3 birdies in a row. That was the thing about Koepka that's so impressive. Like, okay, he started well with a birdie. And then, I mean, you bogey 4 and 5. I think you've every right then as a human being just to be a bit like, oh no.
Absolutely.
And then to respond with 3 birdies in a row. It just reminded me of what I thought of Shinnecock. This guy is mentally phenomenal. He doesn't care. He's not rattled. And he's so much finesse around the greens. Like, the first thing everyone says about Koepka is he's a bomber. And he is. But like, at Shinnecock, you know those horrible bowl greens, upside down bowl greens, where you have to save par with an up and down where you've rolled down to the bottom, and they're horrific, and most players couldn't do it, especially in those greens. Like Koepka on the Sunday, as Johnson sort of went to pieces, was relentless. He's like the finesse around the greens and the putter. He has got everything. This is not just a bomber and the rest of his game is, you know, average.
No, I agree. I know we're going to hear some of the recording of the McGinley interview.
Yeah.
But it is that thing. It's just that in the end, this is what brings Koepka 3 majors in the, you know, of his 4 wins. is, sure, it's the bomber, but it's the, as you said, it's the finesse around the greens. It's the chips, it's the short irons into greens. Like, he's not going long, he's putting him in the right position, and it's draining those putts. He's unbelievably good. And as you say, so the question mark, is he having a kind of Harrington-esque, is he having like this golden autumn, or is he, or a golden spring, because he's kind of early on in his career.
The peak, or, just this weird peak.
Yeah, or is he going to kind of just put the foot down and win a whole bunch of more majors and be the guy that, like, we thought Spieth was going to be the guy, and Dustin Johnson was going to be the guy, and Justin Thomas is going to be the guy, or maybe they're all going to be the guy. But but Brooks Koepka is definitely there. He was amazing, and as much as I was disappointed not to see Tiger win, I was very, very impressed with the way Koepka held it together. And just to finish that point, is that it's that the drive on 17, when the pressure is on him, he hears that roar from 18. So he knows the Tiger's made birdie on 18. Mm. Now, he's got a comfort, he's got a cushion. But you're going to win a major. Like, you know, you could do what Adam Scott just did, but he doesn't. He absolutely murders one down the middle of the fairway. And I just thought it was just like, I was just like, well, that cements for me 4 days of just glorious golf.
Hold all those thoughts for a few moments, Fionn, because we're going to go to Claude Harmon in just a second. Okay, so hopefully Claude Harmon the Third can hear us. You're talking to Joe and Fionn here. Claude, are you there?
I'm here.
Ah, great to have you with us. Thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely, no problem.
So, by the way, one of the worst pieces of trivia of all time, but Fionn and I were just talking a few minutes ago, and I absentmindedly said, who's Claude Harmon the Second, by the way? And he looked at me and said, it's Butch. And I was like, ah, that makes sense, I suppose. Butch isn't his real name.
No. That's a nickname, I think, that stuck from a very young age.
Is that right? Okay. And how did, is it any particular meaning, or was it just like, well, we can't have two Claudes in the house, or?
No, I don't know. I just, my dad said they just called him Butchie Boy as a kid, and it always stuck.
Okay. So, I mean, we were just talking about Brooks Koepka. What an extraordinary performance, and what an extraordinary, 14 months now from Koepka. So I saw your tweet where you were talking in the last few days about how he turned up in Bellerive and he was feeling pretty good about his swing. You didn't have to do a whole lot.
No, I didn't. You know, he thought he really played well at Firestone. He said that's probably the best he's hit it, even, you know, better than at Erin Hills and better than at Shinnecock, but he just didn't putt that well. So the golf swing was pretty much right where he wanted it to be. We did a lot of work early in the week on his putting. He wasn't putting very well. And really, after we made some changes Monday, Tuesday, he started to roll the ball a little bit better. And really, that's some of the best, you know, ball striking I've seen in the 5 years I've been around him.
Yeah, I was reading, and it's great to have you on to almost kind of check some of this stuff. So Koepka, obviously, we know about his prodigious length, and it was moving to the power fade, particularly with the driver, which kind of really moved him to another kind of gear. The quote kind of goes, did he turn to you guys at one point when he was learning the fade with the driver and kind of say, geez, it can't be this easy?
Yeah, the first golf lesson that I had with him, he was trying to hit draws at that time. And, you know, he hit a couple of draws and, you know, in the lesson that we had, and just said, I hate hitting draws. And I just said, you know, that doesn't make any sense. Why are you trying to hit draws? And he said, well, the guy I'm working with at the moment is trying to get me to hit draws. And I said, well, what shape would you like to play? And he said, well, I'd much rather play a fade. And I said, well, if you want to fade it, you know, here are some of the things that I think you could do to fade it. And, you know, he hit four or five of them. And he said, man, it can't be that easy. And I said, well, it has to be that easy, because the level that hopefully you're going to play out one day is going to be, you know, a difficult level. There's going to be a lot of pressure. So if we can have something in your golf swing and build something that's very, very repeatable, that you're comfortable doing, it's a shape that you want to hit, I think it's going to be a lot easier for you. And that's really the stuff that, you know, the stuff that we check and work on last week in his golf swing is the same stuff that we worked on the first golf lesson I had with him, you know, 5 years ago.
Amazing. And so here's the bit where I'll expose my ignorance of the golf swing. But with someone like Koepka, is it, he kind of sets up for a fade and brings the club back and seems to be slightly closed. And is he just kind of hanging on then and just ripping his body through it and doing very little with the hands?
Basically, usually what we try and do with Brooks is he tends to play his best, believe it or not, as a fader of the golf ball, where he gets a little bit kind of closed with his feet, so his feet get aimed a little bit to the right.
Right.
And then he gets a little bit open with his shoulder, so it's kind of a different kind of setup for him. What that allows him to do is basically just keep the golf club, you know, very much in front of him going back, yet he has a very strong grip. The club face is shut at the top. But as long as he keeps rotating there, then he can actually feel like he releases it. The bad shots that Brooks tends to hit are when he doesn't release it, where he kind of holds on and kind of drags and cuts across it. Those are the ones that go a long way to the right. But when Brooks is playing his best, yeah, he feels like the club's, you know, the backswing's outside. He's turning left. He's swinging left. And the more he releases it, believe it or not, the straighter it goes.
Wow. Is it unusual to have a mismatch like that with the feet and the shoulders?
It just works for him. I think, you know, all golfers are very individual. I think because of his grip and because of the way that the club goes back, he tends to take the golf club back in a very, very closed position for the shape that he's trying to hit. When Brooks actually gets aimed too far left, which most people do to hit a fade, when he gets too far left, his shoulders then get too far to the right, and then he just can't get the path left enough. So it's just kind of an easy setup way for him that he kind of feels right with his feet, open with his shoulders. It makes it really kind of fixes the takeaway, so we don't really have to worry too much about the takeaway. And then with his speed and his body, he can really just go ahead and rotate and do the things that yeah. he does when he hits it good.
It's fascinating to get that kind of insight. How often would you work with Brooks across a given month in the height of the season?
Certainly right now on tour, I'm out pretty much most weeks. If I'm not out and he's home, like this week, we'll do some work this weekend. I mean, obviously he's going to take a little bit of time to just, you know, kind of get away from golf. Which I think is really important, and I think Brooks does is very good at finding a balance between, you know, working and then taking some time off. So we'll get together probably Saturday, Sunday, and Monday and hit some balls. But during the week, you know, I walk most practice rounds with him, and
nice.
Whether that's 9 or 18 holes, and we'll hit balls. But the good thing that I think Brooks is unique in that he doesn't have to stand and hit golf balls for 5, 6, 7 hours a day. He's a very good athlete. We try and keep his golf swing incredibly simple so that he can perform. That's kind of the way his brain works. And so he's a very good athlete on top of that. So most of the changes that we make, you know, physically or technically, last week's a good example. He wasn't putting very good.
Mm.
But as soon as we kind of make a few changes, he can pick it up very, very quickly. And then we don't really have to spend, you know, hours upon hours of hitting balls. And when he's home, he also likes to play a lot.
Nice.
He I mean, if we do practice, you know, we might hit balls for, you know, maybe a couple of hours, then, you know, take a break, and then he wants to go play. He wants to go see what's going to happen on the golf course. So that anything that we're working on technically, he wants to see it, you know, in a game type situation.
Yeah.
He just doesn't want to stand and hit golf ball after golf ball.
I was reading a few pieces this week. Alan Shipnuck had won, and there were various others. Koepka overlooked by Florida, the university he wanted to go play college golf at, and overlooked for the Walker Cup team. And, you know, we know about him all over here in Europe with the Challenge Tour and the European Tour. Almost kind of like not getting the recognition maybe he's deserved, and chip on the shoulder might be a bit strong, but there is that almost sense, reading the pieces, and I'm curious for your opinion on this, that he's out to prove a bit of a point, and he understands that, you know, Tiger Woods and all the, you know, the Golden Childs on tour and various other guys are getting lots of attention. And there's almost an element of, well, I'm going to keep winning, and, you know, you're all going to have to start paying attention to me. Is that there with him? Is that fair?
I think because Brooks went over and you know, played in Europe and didn't kind of go through the normal thing that a lot of the guys from the U.S. that go through, they play college. You know, he played college golf, but most of the guys play the U.S. Tour. If they don't play the U.S. Tour, they play the Web.com Tour. And I think because Brooks kind of went over and did things in Europe, I definitely think there have been times, you know, certainly where he does get overlooked. You know, a great example is last year at Erin Hills, he finished his first round. I think he shot 4 or 5 under, and, you know, I do 10, 12 weeks a year for Sky, so I kind of know how the situation works if you want to get an interview. So we're standing in the scoring area, and, well, there's people from the Golf Channel, there's people from Fox, there's people from Sky, there's loads of people, and we stood there for, you know, probably 10 minutes, and his agent finally said is, I wonder if anybody's going to interview him. And I'm like, nobody's going to interview him. They would have asked by now. And he said, well, let's get out of here. So we left, and we were in the car and driving away from the golf course. And I think Fox and the Golf Channel said, hey, we would really like to interview Brooks. And we said, well, you had your chance. But I think there's, you know, the way the media works sometimes, you know, they have their people that they want to interview. And I think Brooks flies under the radar. You know, part of that, I think it probably has something to do with Brooks doesn't show a tremendous amount of emotion on the golf course. I mean, I think that's one thing that people notice about him. He doesn't, you know, get too high, doesn't get too low. But even, you know, Thursday, he's the reigning U.S. Open champion. He's won back-to-back U.S. Opens, which is a feat that really hasn't really happened that often. Mm. He shot one under in a major championship, and he didn't have one person ask him one question, didn't get one media request, didn't get one reporter. And, you know, I think he uses that, you know, certainly for fuel. And he said to me Friday morning warming up, he said, when I shoot 66 today, they'll all want to interview me.
Hmm. Very, very interesting.
You know, I think he went on to shoot, you know, 63, 64, and, you know, he got a lot of interviews. But I think just Brooks' personality is, you know, although it might not be what the media likes, I mean, I think he has the type of personality. Certainly when people ask, you know, why has he won, you know, three majors, and it seems like he wins more majors than he wins, you know, regular tour events. I think he just has a personality that is really, if you could design a personality for a major championship golf, it would be the one that Brooks has. He doesn't really kind of get too up. He doesn't really kind of get too down. When he makes a birdie, he doesn't get super excited. When he makes a double bogey, he doesn't really get too down on himself, because he knows that, you know, he's a good enough player to where he can recover from that. I mean, he made a double bogey early on his front nine on Thursday at Bellerive last week, and you know, came off, shot one under, and came off the golf course when we were driving home. And he said, "Man, I felt like I played really good today." Yeah. Where a lot of guys would have gone, "Man, you know, I made double bogey, but don't make double bogey." He's not a guy that talks about the things negatively on the golf course. Oh, if I wouldn't have done that, I would have been able to shoot a better score. Mm. He's never that guy. He'll just say, "Listen, I made a double bogey early, but I made some birdies on the back nine and felt like I really didn't play that bad. I made one bad swing." And so I think his demeanor and his personality is probably the thing. You know, if you look at his stats right now, you know, his stats don't jump off the, other than his driving distance and things like that. But, you know, if you look at Dustin Johnson's stats right now, I mean, he's the best player in the world. I mean, he's number one in, you know, the majority of the categories that they keep stats. But I think the stat that you can't, that isn't, you know, quantifiable, that there's no kind of, you know, way to measure it, is, you know, your mental strength, how you handle adversity and things like that. And to me, he's one of the best in the world at that.
No, it's so true. I watched his Saturday interview at the US Open at Shinnecock. I think it was with Sarah Sturk. I think it was on Sky. And I remember watching it after the Saturday round and the carnage going on there. And I just, this guy's going to win. There's just a steal here, which is fairly phenomenal. You mentioned Johnson. He's the one other player I wanted to ask you about, Claude, because I know you're a busy man. So it's funny, we're chatting here on the Golf Podcast, and you're talking here to a bunch of golf nerds. All the listeners, they know their golf, they watch their golf, and they know what Johnson can do. And, you know, even watching him win the Canadian Open, and like, it's just like, even the commentary team are just like, this guy's unstoppable when he's on form and he's brilliant and all the rest. And we see him, and you mentioned the stats as well, where he's top basically of everything going. And then you look at the major record, and not to even suggest for a second that we don't appreciate how difficult these things must be to win. You know, Justin Rose has won, Ricky Fowler's still trying, Jason Day has won. Not easy to win by any means. But you look at Johnson and you look at the major haul and you think, there's something not clicking for this guy. Underachievement is such a strong word to use, but he should have more. And I wonder if he's conscious of that.
I think you could say that about a lot of players. I mean, I do think that, you know, it's a cliche, but cliches are cliches because they're true. I mean, major championships are tough to win. And I think if you look at DJ's record, if you look at the amount of, you know, second places, top fives, you know, I think that he's normally there or thereabouts. And I think that's all really that you can do as a player. And I would certainly, I always say this when people ask this question about Dustin, I'd much rather work with a player that has chances every year and is in the mix on the back nine on Sunday to win one than somebody that's never going to get there.
Sure.
And I think because DJ has won so many times on the PGA Tour, you know, 19 times, and, you know, he's only got the one major, you know, I think we're living, you know, in an interesting age that, you know, one major isn't enough anymore. You know, and certainly when you look at someone like Dustin, who has, you know, such unbelievable talent, you know, and it's interesting that to me that a lot of the times, you know, we talk about, you know, major champions that have won one major, and there's no mention of the fact of when they're going to win another one. You know, nobody's talking about when Sergio Garcia is going to win another one. Everybody's just like, oh, well, he won a major.
Yeah.
You know, Justin Rose, you know, Justin Rose is, you know, only has one major, and it would be easy to look at his talent and say, well, he certainly should have won more. But I think all of these players, you know, if you look at guys, you know, certainly DJ's in that category. I think Justin Rose is in that category. Pretty much most of the majors, they're in the mix. They're going to have an opportunity. They're going to be one of the favorites. And really on the back nine on Sunday, they're probably the guys that you're going to see. And in the U.S. Open, you know, DJ had a chance coming down the stretch on Sunday. You know, didn't get the job done the way he wanted it to. He played great through three rounds last week and, you know, didn't get it done. Sometimes, you know, other guys just play better. I think the thing that DJ will continue to do is give himself opportunities, you know, four times a year to win major championships. And I'd be surprised, you know, if he doesn't, you know, get to a guy that could win two or three of them.
Yeah, okay, that's a fair enough answer. About yourself then, are you, I know Butch is based in Las Vegas, are you there as well, or are you out in your own somewhere?
No, we have three golf schools. We have one in Las Vegas, we have one in Dubai where I used to work,
right.
And then we have one in Florida, just north of Jupiter where most of the tour players here on the US Tour live. So I've been here for about 7 years now.
Right, and is it really as linear as there was Claude and then there was Butch, and Butch learned from Claude and you learned from Butch? Is that kind of how it's gone in the Harmon dynasty?
I mean, I worked for my father for a long time and, you know, spent a lot of time around him. And it was also really important for me kind of, you know, around 2000, 2001, I left working for my dad and kind of went to Europe and worked on European tour and just kind of lived on my own and kind of did my own thing and started working, you know, certainly with my own players. And that was a huge, I think for me, a huge part of my development.
Yeah, no doubt.
I worked, you know, with Adam Scott and Darren Clark, and I worked a lot with Trevor Immelman for, you know, 3-4. I've worked with Graham McDowell, and, you know, that's something I'm very proud of, you know, certainly to work with Adam Scott and Trevor and Graham, you know, at a young age of, you know, when they were young guns before they'd really done anything special, you know, they were all still winning tournaments, but, you know, to kind of see young players at a young age and then watch them go on to do, you know, win major championships and do great things. And I think I learned a lot from doing that. And, you know, there's players, you know, certainly like Dustin and Ricky Fowler that, you know, my dad and I both worked with together. And then there's guys, you know, like Brooks Koepka, who I work with by myself, and he works with Gary Woodland by himself. So
yeah, right.
I think there's some collaboration, and then there's some, you know, some things we do apart. But certainly, I mean, you know, the single biggest influence of my, you know, golfing career and my instruction career would be, you know, the work that I did under my dad and watching him, you know, work with all the players that he's worked with over the years. I mean, I don't really think there's any player in the modern era that he hasn't, you know, spent time with. I mean, if you look at the body of work, you know, certainly that he's put together, I mean, it's been an amazing, you know, run from Greg Norman to Davis Love to, you know, Curtis Strange to, you know, the kind of that old guard, and then all of the young players, you know, guys that he's worked with, Tiger and Phil and Fred Couples, and, you know, and then this younger crowd of generation of players. So, you know, when you have a front row seat and access to watch that, you know, for the last, I'm 49 years old, I've been watching my dad give golf lessons since I was about, you know, 13, 14 years old.
Wow, amazing, amazing. If you could take one golf swing to play with for the rest of your life, whose would you take?
I think the way the game is played now, modern, you know, the modern game, I think, you know, you look at the guys that have power and length. I mean, I certainly think the game is, I really don't look at golf swings in terms of, you know, aesthetics. You know, when people ask me about some of my favorite golf swings on tour, you know, I look at guys like, you know, Bubba Watson's one of my favorites, you know, Dustin Johnson, Brooks, Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, because to me, I look at golf swings in terms of, do they provide the player with the ability to win tournaments, and do they win tournaments? So, you know, when you say to me, listen, what's a great golf swing? I said, well, Bubba Watson's got a great golf swing. And most people say, really? I'm like, yeah, because he wins. He's won 2 majors. He's won 3 times this year. Yeah. He plays on Ryder Cups. You know, to me, there's the aesthetic kind of philosophical argument about who's got a pretty golf swing. Guys like Steve Elkington, guys like Sam Snead. Yeah. To me, Lee Trevino has one of the greatest golf swings, you know, of all time, because it produced unbelievable results. So for me, golf is all about, you know, from a technical standpoint, to me, golf is all about function. The beauty and the aesthetic part of it, to me, that's a different conversation. But when I look at players' golf swings, the one thing I look at is, can they win? And do they win? If they win, to me, they have great golf swings, because obviously it works. You know, Zach Johnson has a great golf swing.
Yeah,
guys
for sure.
Won 2 majors in an era to where, you know, guys are hitting it, you know, 50 to 60 yards past him. But, you know, he's won an Open Championship. He's won a Masters. He's played on pretty much every Ryder Cup team we've had in the last 10, 15 years. He's a prolific winner. And so, you know, there are obviously guys out there that have beautiful looking golf swings. You know, to me, Adam Scott probably, of this generation, probably has the best looking golf swing. Mm. So to me, it's always about function and what a player can do, and does his golf swing help him win golf tournaments?
Yeah. When you watch us hackers, mid-handicappers, kind of plodding our way around pro-ams or various other places, maybe you even coach high handicappers as well, is there any kind of broad area where most of us are kind of going wrong?
Yeah, I think the biggest single issue that I see for the average player is they just don't make contact with the golf ball consistently. You know, they don't consistently hit the golf ball in the center of the face, and they don't do it, you know, time after time. And the single biggest way to improve as a player and improve as a golfer is if, you know, you can get the golf ball in the air and hit it in the center of the face. And I know that sounds, oh yeah, well obviously that's a simple answer. But most golfers play golf, if it was tennis, most golfers play golf as a tennis player, they don't get the ball over the net consistently. Mm. You can get the ball over the net every time playing tennis, you can play the game and you can improve quite dramatically. If every time you hit the ball, you know, with a tennis racket and it doesn't go in the court and it doesn't go over the net, you struggle to improve. And I think most of the golfers that I teach, you know, if I'm not on tour, you know, I give golf lessons to regular people, you know, non-tour players, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours a day. And the single biggest thing that they struggle with is contact. But I think what the average golfer is obsessed with is direction. They're obsessed with the direction their golf ball is going, whether it's fading, hooking, slicing, drawing. They're always talking about the direction it goes. And, you know, I think if you could stand on the first tee, you know, the next time you go out and play golf on Saturday morning and someone had a little genie bottle that they could rub and say, listen, I can rub the genie bottle and I can give you one of two things. I can tell you which shape you're going to hit today. So if you want to hit it left to right, I can tell you every shot you're going to hit today is left to right. If you want to hit it right to left, I can tell you every shot's going to be right to left. I just can't tell you if you're going to hit it solid. Or I can rub the genie bottle and say, listen, I can't tell you which direction it's going to go today. But every shot you hit is going to be in the middle of the club face, and it's going to be solid. Mm. I think most golfers would take the solid contact over the direction. Mm. But what I think golfers do is they obsess about the shape that they're hitting. And I'm not really, you know, a guy that really cares whether players hit it left to right or right to left, whether they hit draws or fades. The only thing I care about is if you hit it solid. And I think if you spent a year with a guy like Brooks Koepka or Justin Rose or Jordan Spieth, the thing that would blow you away, like, you know, I spend 20, 25 weeks a year with these guys on tours, 95% of their shots are solid.
Yeah.
They just don't not hit it solid.
Yeah.
And I think more golfers, if they focused on the contact and building the contact really from, you know, from small swings, because if you can't hit 100 golf balls, you know, solid with a sand wedge kind of going waist high back and waist high through, by the time you get up to your driver, you know, you're not going to have that. But I think most golfers are trying to run, you know, marathons before they learn how to walk. And I think, you know, the contact to me is the single most important thing. And it's probably the thing that I think is overlooked, especially for beginning golfers. Beginning golfers are always trying to, they want to start hitting drivers, you know, way too early. They want to try to make big swings way too early. And so what I do, you know, in a lot of my lessons is just break everything down to a really small kind of beginner level and say, listen, let's just get the club on the ball solid. And if you can do it, then we can start building a bigger swing. Then we can start driving the car a little faster.
Okay. One last question or two. Or if you have to go, please say, there's no issue whatsoever. Would you have been, I don't know what age, would you have been around when Tiger was working with your dad first? Would you have got to watch them?
Yeah, no, then? I mean, Tiger's a, what was that like? He used to come and stay at our house, and I used to pick him up at the airport, take him to Burger King because he didn't have any money. And my job was to wake him up. You know, when he used to stay at our house, I'd go down and wake him up, and he'd fall back asleep. So I'd set my alarm early, go down, wake him up, go take a shower, and then go back down and wake him up again.
What was it like watching that, like, once in a generation and beyond talent kind of form and be chiseled out around that time?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was an amazing experience to see, you know, to see a kid that was 16 years old and then go on and become a dominant, you know, force in the game and all the things that he's done. You know, it's been fun to watch. It was great to see Tiger, you know, back. I think that's one of the most satisfying things for Brooks. You know, when we were flying back Sunday night, he was saying, you know, I got to play Tiger Woods down the stretch in a major.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't old, you know, it wasn't hurt Tiger. It was Tiger doing what Tiger does, you know, making birdies, the crowds going crazy. I mean, I haven't seen crowds like that in a long time. And it was just great to see Tiger back in the mix. You know, I thought him waiting around and you know, congratulating Brooks and shaking his hand was something pretty special. But I think just for this younger generation of players to have Tiger back and to have him competing, you know, to have him with opportunities to win golf tournaments as opposed to doing what he's done for the last 3 or 4 years, which is you never knew if he was going to play, you never knew if he was going to finish, and you certainly never thought that he was going to have a chance to win. Now I think Tiger has a legitimate chance to win some golf tournaments.
Yeah.
So, and it's great for the game. I mean, that's what we want.
Yeah.
Players want to play against him, for sure.
Kind of amazing when you kind of, even to think there was a time when Tiger Woods didn't have money or, you know, buying a McDonald's and getting him out of bed. From the 15, 16, 17-year-old that you came across then to the dominant player and then obviously the fallout in his personal life and everything else, and everybody's familiar with that, to the Tiger that's kind of re-emerged. Like, it was quite kind of an amazing moment when you saw Brooks kind of walk around the corner and there's Tiger waiting for him at the locker room. That, like, Woods was not in the habit of waiting for the guy who might have beat him, and it didn't happen often. You know, that's not the Tiger that we used to see, and we're seeing a softer, maybe more engaged Tiger. Like, when you step back in particular and look at kind of the full journey, what do you make of where Tiger is in his life now, Claude? Are you close enough to even want to comment?
I think it's kind of Tiger 2.0. I mean, I certainly think, you know, with some of the things that, you know, have happened to him off the golf course, you know, I think it humbles you. You know, I think the struggles that he's had, you know, personally, you know, have kind of shaped kind of the person he is today. I think having kids is very, very, you know, different,
yeah.
You know, for Tiger. Tiger's life when he was younger was all about himself. And for those of us, you know, I have a 15-year-old daughter. I mean, your life is, you know, not about you as your kids get older. You know, Tiger came up to our course and played with, you know, the former president, Barack Obama, in December. And, you know, he parked his car next to mine and looked at the back of his car. I mean, the back of his car looks like the back of my car. There's tennis rackets. There's, you know, there's swim gear. There's backpacks. There's, you know, food wrappers and stuff like that, you know, because he's got kids and he's picking them up and taking them to school and, you know, and taking them to swim practice and baseball practice, soccer practice, and all those things. So I think Tiger's life has changed a lot. Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's great to see him. I mean, he seems much more happy. I mean, there's less, I think, of a barrier around him right now.
Right.
I mean, certainly with the, there might still be a little bit of that, you know, with the media. I mean, he seems to be a little bit more open in his press conferences, but, you know, he plays practice rounds now with guys that he would never play practice rounds before, you know, whereas before it was, you know, basically like getting an audience with the Pope.
Okay.
Try and play a practice round with him.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know,
but
now he goes out and he plays practice rounds, and he seems really, really happy. You know, I mean, he seems, you know, very approachable, and You know, I think his game is moving in the right direction. I mean, I think the performance he had on Sunday, you know, to almost have a chance to win a major and hit no fairways on the front nine and shoot, I think he shot 3-4 under on the front is, I mean, it's a joke how good that is. Yeah. You know, on a golf course to where if you hit it offline, you know, with your driver, you're struggling to make a par. I mean, yes, the fairways at Bellerive were, they were, you know, generous and they were, the course was soft, but, you know, I think you saw Brooks, he missed fairways on the front at 4 and 5 and he made bogeys. I mean, he just couldn't play from there. And for Tiger to not hit any fairways on the front nine, I mean, I thought the shot that he hit on the ninth hole was just, as soon as he hit that shot and hit it to 15 feet, I said, he'll make the putt and he's going to play good on the back nine. And, you know, it was special. And I think when he's at an event, the events are different. And, you know, I was talking to earlier in the year at the Honda, I was talking to Harry Diamond, Rory's caddy. They played in LA with him. I said, how was it? And he said, man, I couldn't believe how many people were out there. And I jokingly said, I said, man, you should have seen it. I said, this is the farewell tour. I mean, back when it was Beatlemania, I mean, it was crazy. And last week felt like that, you know, with the crowds in St. Louis, because there isn't a regular PGA Tour event and they don't see golf. I mean, it was 10 deep. And then every day, I mean, there were crowds on Monday, which are normally like there are crowds on a Thursday. So Tiger brings that. And I think, you know, for a generation of fans who never saw him play either. I mean, there's people at that tournament last week that have never seen Tiger play. I mean, we all just take it for granted that everybody has seen him do it. You know, a lot of people, you know, with the, you know, since 2008, it really has been kind of a stop start for Tiger. You know, that's 10 years of injuries, coming back, injuries, coming back, injuries. So now that he's back, you know, there's a whole generation of people that are able to watch him do things in real life as opposed to watching him, you know, do great things on YouTube and on and in reruns on TV. So it's great for the game. And I know all the players currently playing love having him back. They love competing against him. And, you know, Brooks loved going down the stretch with him. And then, I think for Brooks, you know, that's one of the things I'm most proud of, because there aren't that many people that could, I think, that could put up with that. You know, knowing that Tiger's up in front of you, you know, two groups in front of you, and I mean, the noise was unbelievable. You know what's coming. You know, you've been to golf tournaments. You know the Tiger roars and you know everything else. The start that he got off to, you know, Brooks hasn't even teed off yet. We were on the putting green and we could hear what Tiger was doing. And I told him before he went off, I said, listen, everybody's going to make a run today. I said, Tiger's going to make a run. You focus on what you're doing and you play the way that you can play and you're going to have a chance, you know, with a couple holes left to win the golf tournament.
That's great advice. His three birdies after the two bogeys, incredible. Listen, you've been so good with your time. Please tell me, by the way, that you're giving Barack Obama lessons. Tell me you're his teacher.
I have given him some lessons in the past. You know, I've worked with him, you know, on three different occasions, and, you know, he loves golf. He loves sports. You know, he's a great guy to be around, and, you know, I always enjoy the time that I get to spend with him. You know, he's a really... you know, he's a fun guy to be with.
And, he just seems funny. He just seems like you're going to be a lot of laughs.
You know, it's funny. His golf game has improved. Yeah, I think the first time I worked with him was 2013, and then worked with him again in 16, and then worked with him in December. And I said to the former president, I said, your golf game is much better. And he looks, you know, 15 years younger because he said, you know, he's sleeping and getting to practice more, but he loves the game and, you know, he just loves being around golf. He's just like the rest of us.
Yeah. What would he be down to now, give or take?
I think he's probably legit in his teens. You know, he just has more time to play. And the other thing he has more time to do now, I think, is practice. The first time I worked with him, I said, listen, do you have any opportunity to practice? And he said, you know, obviously with my schedule, if I can get out and get 2 or 3 hours, I'm going to try and go play.
Yeah.
I'm not going to try and practice. Where I think now, he has an opportunity to practice, and he's a cool guy.
Yeah, geez, what an amazing thing to do. You've been so good with your time, and again, congratulations. I mean, it's an unbelievable time for you in your own career, in a way, with all this success. So, Claude, thanks a million.
Thank you.
There we are, that's Claude Harmon. Fiona, you still there?
It was very interesting. One of the interesting things about the stuff he was saying about Brooks, there's two things that struck me, is that if he's been able to kind of improve in a bubble where people just ignore him. That's all over now.
Yeah.
So whether he is a little shy is not the word, but reserved, he has to. That's all changed. He's a three-time major winner. He's won two U.S. Opens on the bounce, two majors in 1 year. That's all different now. He's going to be one of the top guys to be interviewed at every tournament he goes to from here on in. So it's just curious that whether I'm sure he understands that that's going to happen, but is he ready for it? That was one thing I wanted to ask him about. Then the other thing that really strikes me is that I share his enthusiasm for Tiger Woods' return. And as much as it might be his farewell tour, it's one hell of a farewell tour. But then there's a way of seeing this slightly concerning as well, is that the single biggest deal in golf is a 42-year-old guy who is really kind of in the twilight of his career.
Yeah.
And that's troubling. It's great now, but I think I wonder if it's worrying for the middle to maybe not the long term health of golf, but certainly the middle term health of golf.
Yeah,
I think it's asking. So because, I mean, it's not as if the game isn't populated by some extraordinary players, two of whom are coached by Claude, you know. But then, yeah, Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, Rory McIlroy, if he ever, you know, manages to figure out what's stopping him from winning. But, you know, these guys, not one of them can hold a candle to Tiger.
It would have been one of those, it struck me, it would have been one of those kind of tournaments where, like, if Tiger wasn't in it, we would have said, God, interesting tournament, and golf's in such a good place, and all these young players were on the charge. But then when you drop Tiger into it, the whole thing still revolved around him. Like, everything, he is the sun, and everybody's just floating around him. The mad thing with Tiger is he can't find a fairway, though, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
just when you're obviously swinging the club well, like he couldn't have been swinging his irons much better, and still the driver wouldn't behave.
Yeah, but it never really did. I mean, I'm open to be proven wrong, but I wonder now. It's particularly bad if he's missing. Like, he made 0 of 7 fairways on the front nine on Sunday, but. Yeah. Like, you know, Tiger won 14 majors, never really being that consistent with his driver and always struggling to make fairways. I'm not saying he's exactly the same now, but in a weird way, there's a strange paradox to it, is the swing he's got now is better suited to controlling that driver than the swing he used to have, I think. Mm. Like, I think he'll fix it. I think he'll fix the swing that'll get him, I don't know, maybe more consistent on the fairway. But as I said, he never really was that consistent. Did you see the one? Okay, so I'll give you, I just have it written down. It's the one of on the par 4 ninth. So he goes wide left. The 9-iron he hit from the tree line and then put it to whatever, almost like tap in birdied. That's the shot of the tournament.
Yeah.
Because he was so, because as Claude was saying about Brooks, so he missed two fairways in the front nine, made bogey on both. Tiger Woods was all over the place. Like, he's staring double bogey, say for the sake of argument. And on one, like, he was saving par and making birdies. And yeah. I was just like, oh my God, that was unbelievable. I haven't felt as excited. I was very excited when Jordan Spieth went on that run at the Open Championship last year.
Mm.
But what I never really thought Tiger was going to win, to be honest. I always thought Koepka was...
Same.
You know what I mean? It was like, what I really wanted, and no disrespect to poor old Adam Scott, but like, I really was glad, this is going to sound awful, I was glad that Scott birdied the 18th, bogeyed the 18th, to leave Tiger a sole share of second place.
I know, same.
Yeah.
Is the Adam Scott so he's back using the long putter? Is this contentious? And like, I want to be really,
yes,
really careful here, but like, Scott is such a gent, and
yeah, I know he is.
You would hate, you know, if you get too close to implying you're bringing the C word in, and yeah. I just want to run a million miles away from that with Adam Scott.
It's the same with Bernard Langer last year. When he was, because there was video of Langer who's brushing his shirt as he moves the putter.
Yeah.
Like, now, obviously, with the terrible feed, there is not one suggestion that Scott is brushing any item of his clothing with this putter, that he's deliberately holding it away from his body and then just kind of got that long anchor thing going on. And that's the only thing. It's like, I mean, ultimately, you resolve the issue, and I'm with those guys. The putter should, the driver should be the longest club in your bag and no other. It's
It might be the real change they have to make. Isn't 100%. It, isn't it amazing, though, that he's now back in the mix, using it again, even though not anchoring it?
Yeah, but he's such a good player, really. And it's funny because I think, and we just to kind of allude to what we were talking at the beginning of the pod, is the lack of coverage of other players. And that's, so you don't get as rounded a picture.
No,
and it's
true.
Hard. It's hard to talk about Adam Scott.
Yeah,
really.
It's true. It's true.
You don't see him as often.
Shane Lowry, hard to talk about. We're gonna play an interview with him out later on, and he's at the Wyndham this week. He needs a kind of top 10, top 12 finish to secure his card. Didn't see much of him. So we'll hear from him. And then,
well, he played well.
Yeah, no, for sure. And he's had three great weeks. And
yeah.
In the interview, he talks about, like, you know, he said him and Dermot were on the flight from Bellarive down to the Wyndham. And they sat beside...
No, not Dermot. Oh, really?
Yeah. He said they sat beside each other. And they want to be great friends still. And they don't want this to be acrimonious. And he didn't want to say too much about it. But he said that much. He said, like, it was horrible having to do it. And... They were on a charter flight down from Bellarive to Wyndham this week, and they sat beside each other on the flight down.
That's actually really nice to hear. Yeah. Only because, well, we know Dermot. So
I don't really know him at all. You do.
Okay, I know him. I don't know him. He's not we're not friends or anything, but I do know him. And when you know someone, when you've actually met them and had chats with them, like when you hear that they've lost
their job.
You know, I know you've lost their job. I know he owns a house, I know he has a family, I know he has kids. And so I'd love to see Dermot do okay no matter what. Like, and in fairness to Shane, like, whatever changes he feels he needs to make are obviously legitimate to him. Mm. And like, in the end, like, Shane has got to take care of his career. And so, but it's nice to hear that, like, whereas I always suspected with Rory and JP that their declaration of undying friendship to the end of time was always more for media, only by virtue of the fact that JP is 20 years older than Rory and probably moves into very different circles. But it's nice to hear that, maybe they won't be tight buddies, but you know what? They're still going to be okay. And but isn't that kind of a Lowry thing anyway? Lowry's the kind who would always kind of say hiya to you if, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's not personal in the end.
Yeah. So you'll hear from Lowry in a second. And then the other interview is Paul McGinley. We talk about...
This is an interesting one.
Yeah, we talk about lots in this interview, and McGinley is brilliant in this. And I think, unfortunately, his words got a bit twisted, and we may have kind of not written the best headline as well, which is unfortunate. But anyway, that's all been rectified, and we've spoken to him. But the point he made was that the word average was used. He wasn't saying McIlroy was average, but he was talking about at the upper echelon of the game, his wedge play at the moment can and probably should be described as average, which is, you know, absolutely right.
But why are we so afraid to say that?
But the more interesting thing for me was he said that now the psychological shift for Rory, and Peter Lawrie said it here a few weeks ago, but it was very interesting to see McGinley agrees. McGinley said if Rory now has his A game, he said he doesn't think he's better than Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson and Justin Thomas. So he's gone from being, it was the great cliche in the game, if Rory's at his best, he wins. He's now dropped three places on that order. And McGinley was saying he now has to go and play his best. And then he's in a real, real arm wrestle where he's going to have to almost be cuter than those around him and play really clever, good strategic golf. That's unbelievable. That's a massive change in the last 18 months.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe I've underestimated or overestimated the ability of others. I thought that Dustin Johnson, I thought Dustin Johnson matches Rory for ability. I thought that Jordan Spieth doesn't have quite the swing, and he obviously doesn't hit it the prodigious distance that Rory does. But like since Spieth has been on tour, like would anybody argue about mental strength or the ability to put the ball in the hole? So I've always felt that like that kind of realization has been. That was established, I think, a number of years ago. And it's not to denigrate Rory, obviously, who is a prodigious driver of the ball, beautiful striker of irons, but whose short game is, I don't know, his short game hasn't been anywhere for a long time.
I was watching a good bit of him and Spieth, and Woods because they were in the featured group on 11 Sports on the app, and I was kind of out and, like, playing the same holes. Like, the 11th was that short par 4 and they all laid up and they all hit wedges on, and like Woods and Thomas both made birdie, and like Rory was honestly 25 feet away, and it was just like, I think it was this weird thing of where for Rory this week there was no car crash moment, there was no quadruple bogey on the 5th which ruined him. He just, death by a thousand cuts, by a thousand poor wedge shots, he just watched the tournament slowly but surely leave him behind. It was just a train taking off and he was in the platform. That was his week.
Okay, so to be, I don't mean charitable in the sense that he deserves any kind of charity, but to be fair or balanced, right?
Always a fan of that.
Yeah, Claude made a very, very good point. You put it to him that for someone of Dustin Johnson's talent, why doesn't he win more majors? I mean, I know you finesse the question a little better than I've just done. But, and Harman's answer is very, very good. His answer is like, because it's really hard to win majors. And you've got a lot of guys. But here's the thing, right? Rory comes on the scene. Rory is obviously a, you know, top of the world golfer. Always has been since he was a little kid. He's not in the same realm as Tiger Woods. He just isn't. But he came into the game as the guy who was going to fill Tiger Woods' shoes. Mm. And the expectations on him were way in excess of what really a guy of his talent deserves. It's the same logic that applies to why Dustin Johnson doesn't win more majors, why Jason Day hasn't won more majors, why Jordan Spieth somehow can't put away some majors in the last year or two. It's those same pressures apply to Rory McIlroy. And so this idea that somehow Rory should be stretching away with 10 majors is just insane.
Yeah, it's starting to feel that way, isn't it?
But it bears no, and it's unfair because Tiger Woods is not just a once in a generation. He's a once in a century golfer. Mm. In the sense, well, maybe him and Nicklaus and I just think that, like, yeah, I'm as guilty of it as anybody. In fact, I'll hold my hands up and say I'm often more guilty of it than a lot of people that I read or listen to. You know, I can be quite hard on him and go, why didn't he do this? And when you think about it, actually, it's just like, well, as you said, that he didn't make any big mistakes in this tournament. It just wasn't there.
He just didn't have it. Yeah.
It didn't have it. But Dustin Johnson didn't make any big mistakes. He just didn't have it this week. Mm. And
it's interesting, actually, Damian McGrain made a point last week. This was it on air or off air? It doesn't actually matter because it's a fair enough point. I was sort of saying to him, like, by his own admission, McGrain, not a good ball striker, like, by the lofty standards. Mm. And I was saying, so, like, I said to him, I remember following you at Wentworth and you were Martin Keimer at the weekend. And, like, Keimer in the par fives, it was, like, you know, as good as it gets. And McGrain was, like, hacking there in three. I use that term.
I know what you mean.
Adoringly.
And like, he knows what you mean.
If you want to see hacking, watch us play. Like,
you.
Yes. So I said, like, how, that would put me off my game. Like, how did you even, that must be awful to have to go after Keimer on the par five. And he said, he said, what you need to remember about golf is that when you don't have it, he goes, like, the reason Keimer was paired with me at the weekend is because he was ordinary that weekend. He'd been ordinary on the Thursday and Friday. And he goes, when you're ordinary, you're ordinary. Like, you just don't have it. Like, you come right down to whatever level. And so it's fine playing with him at the weekend. Maybe Thursday, Friday different if they're playing really well. But he said, at the weekend, he might be Martin Keimer and everything, but he's playing ordinary. And if you don't have it, you don't have it. There's very few of the sports where, you know, the Leo Messi would drop down a suitable level to meet whatever.
That's a good point.
McGrain is, but that happens in golf. And to be fair, Rory had one of those weeks. He finished second at the Open.
A number of years ago, maybe 10 years ago, I caddied for an Irish player called Kieran McMonagall as he went for the qualifying at the British Open at Baltrae.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting. So he's paired, and it annoys me that I can't remember who it was, but it was a Swedish player who subsequently, I know, went on the pro tour, and I don't know if he's had a decent career or not.
Henrik Stenson.
But I'd love to say it was Henrik Stenson, but I don't know if it was. But, and Kieran could hit a long ball.
Yeah.
And anybody listening who might be familiar with him or has ever seen him play will know that this guy could hit a decent ball off the tee. Like, maybe, I don't know, 290 through the air.
Right.
Like, he definitely was solid, very strong. the Swedish guy, so we're at Baltre, so you're on links. The Swedish guy was like 80 yards past him every time.
Yeah.
And it was unbelievable. I was watching a guy who hits it long by any standard, but the standard of the very top tier of golf. And I was just watching, and I said it to afterwards, I was like, does a guy like that get you down?
Mm.
And Kieran just turns around and he goes, yeah, but he made par, I made par.
Yeah, I know.
So there you go.
You have to be mentally strong. I guess we've got to bring this to a close. Any other takeaways you want to mention from Bellerive? We've got now FedEx Series on the way to be followed by Ryder Cup. That's all on the horizon. But that's our major year done.
Tiger, will he definitely get the captain's pick for the Ryder Cup?
Presume so. I presume if nothing else, TV producers would say, if you don't pick him, you'll never work in this town again.
Here's my question to you.
Yeah.
What if Tiger says, you know what, I need to rest my back?
Oh, no problem then. Come and be the vice captain. I mean, it'd be a pity. Right. It'd be a pity. Though, I think he was half saying he might play and be vice captain. He was like, I might try and do both. But,
nice.
Yeah. I mean, look, he probably can't play 36 in a day, even though he says he can. You wouldn't risk that. But, like, geez. I mean, the more interesting one is, would you take Phil? Tiger's
a
no-brainer.
Captain's pick.
Yeah.
No, Tiger's a no-brainer. I think Webb Simpson.
Really?
Webb Simpson. I think Webb Simpson's a very good choice. And do you know who else? Bryson DeChambeau.
Yeah, he's been talked about as a potential fourth.
Yeah.
But unlikely. Phil, I don't know. I mean, the list is quite compelling. We'll look at it again. I need to dig it out. But it's a strong list.
And only because we're in sports and sports people love this kind of comparative stuff. Is like, as a comeback, well, actually, is it more improbable, Tiger's comeback, is it more improbable than Hogan's?
This is blown up this week. So, and I don't know enough about, and none of us do. That is the point, actually. If anyone in this debate is giving it to you strongly, then, you know, they're one of those types. But what I've seen is, like, Tiger was obviously in terrible way. I've seen, like, Branel Chambly argue strongly that Woods, by a distance, is the greatest comeback, much better than Hogan's. Like, he couldn't move, he couldn't walk. And not, you know, it was an ongoing issue. It wasn't like a car crash like Hogan.
Yeah.
Like he says Hogan was in the prime of his career. He broke his bones. They mended and he picked up right where he left off.
Yeah.
But then I saw Dermot Kelly tweeting something like, you know, Hogan was on life support. They thought he would die and he came back and played. Now, you know, look, none of us are doctors. None of us know what anyone's
facing.
Well,
actually, Fionn Davenport, MD. No, I listened to Branel Chambly and then I did some research. And because I'd always assumed that Ben Hogan broke his back, he didn't actually break his back.
Right.
He broke his collarbone, he broke ribs, and he was on life support because he was injured. But once he was out of critical danger, he was fine.
Yeah.
In terms of that he wasn't going to die. And the healing process, so the argument that was, so a healed collarbone, broken ribs, et cetera, was a much less arduous healing journey than Tiger Woods, who's had four fusion surgeries on his back.
I think only the last one's a fusion, but
But and also, although you have to counter as well with another thing as well, is that Hogan's accident was in 1949 and medical, you know, technology in 1949 was a hell of a ways back to what it is today.
Yeah.
So had what happened to Tiger happened to him in 1949, Tiger would never have swung another club ever again.
Well, the interesting line from Faldo this week was two champions dinners ago. Faldo heard Tiger tell another champion at the Augusta Champions Dinner, I'm done. It's over. I'm finished.
Wow.
Yeah.
There you go.
So as Faldo says, it's the greatest comeback in golf. And if he wins major, he argues it'll be the greatest in sport. But yeah, the Champions
Dinner. Well, I think
it'll
be Muhammad Ali beating George Foreman.
Yeah.
If Tiger Woods wins another major, it'll have the same import in sporting terms as Ali beating Foreman in 1974.
I know. Do you know, the thing that struck me about Bellerive and the Open, amazing, brilliant, but also, like, you got to do it soon. Like, you're definitely going to be older than the average 43, 44, 45-year-old because your body, like, you do walk like an old man. Like, just to get to 15, to make the comeback. Like, he's, you know, 2020 is less likely than 2019 and 2021 is less likely again. Like, these are actually, I know it's a harsh thing to say given his circumstances.
Yeah, I agree.
But, like, geez, these are big chances. You got to try and grab one of them.
Yeah. You and I, when you watch Tiger make birdie at 18 and that kind of, you know, the fist pump, the Tiger Woods fist pump. To me, I read that fist bump as, I'm going to win a major next year.
I hope you're right.
That's what I saw.
Yeah, I hope that's you're right.
What I, not, like, Tiger's no fool. He knows that Koepka has got a three-shot lead and Koepka's not blowing up.
Yeah.
I thought that fist bump was like one, because also, have you noticed that Tiger's thrown in the odd bogey on 18 in rounds where he's playing very well and you're like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But that he managed to put that birdie down and that massive fist bump to me said, yeah, I'm back. This is me. 100% I'm back. And now I believe I can win another major and I will win another major next year. That's what I thought. Oof.
I'm getting goosebumps.
I know, me too.
Listen, we got to wrap this up. Sorry, I mean, I know we kept you there during the...
No, it's fine. No, no. Do you know, it was a very interesting interview to listen to. As I said, I just had those two questions for him, but he's a fascinating guy. And although, did you notice, just finally, one thing that I will say to you is that when you asked him about his dad, he was at pains in his tone rather than his words, at separating, at putting a distance between him and Butch. He's like, you know, I know, my Butch is a great coach, but I'm also a great coach in my own way.
I can imagine your Butch's son, really, for...
Well, yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It is tough. But, Jesus, I mean, his career is unbelievable
amazing.
At the moment.
Amazing. Yeah.
Those Harmons knew what they were doing.
Yes, they did.
Listen, thanks again so much. And
cheers,
we'll talk to you in the next few weeks. Cheers, Fionn.
Cheers.
So that was Fionn Davenport. Now, if you've already heard the Paul McGinley and Shane Lowry interviews on Off the Ball, then feel free to fly off now. There's no issues. But if you haven't, here we go. So we'll give you Paul McGinley first. Obviously, he wasn't on Sky over the weekend, so it was great to get him on. We had him on Monday nights Off the Ball and get his analysis. Lots of interesting stuff in this. So here's how we got on with Paul McGinley on Monday.
Hi. Evening, Joe.
Dramatic stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was, the return of Tiger. You know, he's been making noises all right around the game in the last, 9 months, 10 months since he's come back. But this was a very loud noise that he made, and it certainly was a Tiger charge on Sunday.
Yeah, I don't want to fall into that trap of talking about Tiger first when there's another champion. You know, you feel sorry for the other guy, whoever that other guy is, when it's up against Tiger like this. So Brooks Koepka, I guess this is part of the question. He's a touch overlooked and underappreciated and maybe has a slight chip on his shoulder about it, understandably. Like, he was overlooked for his chosen university, Florida, he wanted to go to when he was coming out of high school. He was overlooked for the Walker Cup team. He ended up on the Challenge Tour where he did very impressive things, and then the European Tour, and has sort of emerged fully formed now on the PGA Tour. Three of his four PGA Tour wins have been majors. I know you really, really rate this guy. From memory at the Sky Zone... the Sky Zone, how we missed it. But on the at the Sky Zone at the British Open, I think from memory someone asked you during the summer who you would take from the US Ryder Cup team if you could take anyone. I think you said Koepka.
Yeah. I mean, he's been there. We'd like to hijack him as European. He's if you're around the players' lounges and stuff, even at the major championships, you know, he hangs around with the European players a lot. He sees himself as friends with the European guys. He played a lot on the European Tour. He's very familiar with not just the players, the caddies as well, and the people around it. And I think that background of, you know, it didn't all fall into place from coming out of college. He struggled. He didn't get his card in the PGA Tour, came over to Europe, went to the Challenge Tour, got his card through that, and spent a few years in Europe and kind of got his grounding in professional golf in that way, traveling, going to different countries, going to Asia, going to Australia, South Africa. And I think all of those things have really stood to him in terms of his golf apprenticeship. And now we have culminating in probably the hottest player in the world at the moment, you'd have to say, in having won two majors this year.
Describe his game for people, Paul.
Well, I mean, it's all obviously based around power. I mean, it's he smashes the ball. End of story. You know, like most of the top players nowadays, he overpowers the golf course. That's his one way of playing. You know, you put him on Carnoustie when you had to duck and dive and a little bit and play short of bunkers and kind of move the ball left to right. And well, it's unfair to say he was all at sea, but it didn't play into his domain. But when you get a big, long, wet, soft golf course like he did last week, he comes to the fore. Having said that, his win in the US Open is a lot to be admired there, because that was a tough test of golf. It was a real test of mental strength and the ability to forget, which is often talked about in terms of resilience in the game of golf. And he has that. You look at all his interviews. I watched all the interviews very closely every night, because that U.S. Open more than any was about attitude, and never once did he complain, never once did he, you know, go on about the golf course or the setup. It was like, you know, it is what it is. Same for everybody. Okay, it might come across as, you know, not the smartest guy, but I think intellectually, from a golf point of view, he's very smart, and he gets it, and he gets what he has to do.
He does have finesse around the greens as well, and he can hole a putt when he needs to.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Excellent stroke. I know he does a lot of work in the short game with Pete Cowan, who's been who's very influential in the short game, particularly when he played over here in Europe. You know, Pete is highly regarded. Probably a lot of the players would say, not all of them, but a lot of them would say that Pete's a better short game coach than he is a long game coach. And some of the top players in America, Brooks included, go to see him for their short game only.
Yeah. So he's finished in the top 25 now in his previous seven majors, previous to the 2017 US Open. He's had four top 10 finishes in majors since 2014. If you include his wins, he's eight top 10s in majors. And as I mentioned, three of his four wins have been majors. He was talking last night in his press conference, and he just said he loves them. He talked about how he feels he has more patience at these kind of tournaments than regular PGA Tour events. He's got his routine down. The chef comes. They have the house. Seems to really enjoy it. Feels instantly at home at it. And that ties in with your point about mental strength. Like, you never felt... you give your take, but you never overly felt at Shinnecock at the US Open back in June that he was going to relinquish the lead or wobble badly. And even with Tiger doing miraculous things last night, you never fully felt that Koepka was going to give it to him. Like, mentally, this guy's got something really special.
Yeah, I mean, let's just talk about the mental aspect of the game a little bit, Joe, because a lot of people have a misunderstanding of what the mental game in golf is. And to be quite honest, it's being in the zone is about simplicity. It's about not much going on in your head, about reacting to the target, about... not over intellectualizing what you're doing or how you're doing it. You're just seeing it, you're doing it, you're going around almost in a daze. Now, that can come across as, oh, he's not very bright or he's quite dim, and something DJ is accused of, Dustin Johnson's accused of, and Brooks is in that way too. And that's being in the zone. That's what all the guys are trying to get into. And the difficulty is, particularly for somebody who's naturally inquisitive, like DeChambeau, for example, or Patrick Harrington is another example, you know, it's much more difficult for those guys to get in the zone. And that's what makes it... that's what makes it so fabulous when they do win a tournament, is that they'll talk about the simplicity of what they did, and not they didn't win the game with their head, or they didn't win the game with over intellectualizing what they were doing. They just went out and got in the zone and kept things as simple as possible and did it. And that's a very much a natural state of mind, certainly as Dustin Johnson seems to get into a lot. And I think Brooks Koepka is the same way. And that's really what it is all about. It's not being over-intelligent. It's actually being quite the opposite, where you're just reacting to the target and kind of going along in somewhat of a daze.
Yeah, for people who didn't see it last night, he bogeyed 4 and 5. And that would be a very human moment if you reacted to that under the pressure, the roars. They all talked about hearing the tiger roars all day. But instead, he regrouped, he birdied 7, 8 and 9. Just one last point on Koepka, and I'll ask you the question after we play this audio. In his post-round press conference last night, this kind of an interesting point. This guy's really, really hungry. So, you know, he won his US Open last year, and then he missed the Masters this year with his wrist injury, which it turns out was career-threatening. And that's given him a new perspective on his game, and he talked about discipline a lot in his press conference last night. Here's just a brief snippet. So, you know, he was asked how he's managed this level of performance and success after that injury in the early part of the season.
I think sitting on the couch made me really appreciate how much I actually love this game and love competition. When you're out of competition, I don't want to say I was depressed, but I was definitely down. And to finally have the chance to come back and play, I can't tell you how excited I was. I mean, I couldn't wait to get off the couch, couldn't wait to get up in the morning. And some of those days, I don't think I moved off the couch at all. I got fat, gained about 15, 20 pounds. That's never fun. And I just kept telling myself, kind of talk to myself and be like, all right, one day at a time, just keep going. You're getting closer and closer. And then finally to get the okay from the doctors, I've never been more focused, more driven, more excited to play. and really embracing what's around me. I feel like I've done a very good job of that when I've come back, and I just need to keep that up because obviously it's working.
Yeah, it sure is. So the question then, on the last one on Koepka, if we talk about the post-Tiger generation, and I appreciate Tiger's come back into the mix now, but the post-generation, the generation after Tiger, Rory is maybe the elder statesman with his four majors, and you've got, you know, Dustin Johnson still stuck on one, Paul. You've got Jason Day still stuck on one. Justin Rose, Ricky Fowler still to get off the mark. These things are incredibly difficult to win. This guy's parachuted in with three. Could he be the late bolter in this generation to end up with the most majors?
Well, I mean, at this moment in time, he's in the sweet spot, Joe. I mean, he's in the sweet spot that Rory has been in the past, that Dustin Johnson has been in, where the game is simple, life is simple. He doesn't have a lot of responsibilities outside playing golf. Golf is all that he does, and he just goes and he does it. He's not interested in business. He doesn't have a family. He's enjoying life. He's hanging out with his friends, and that's what he's doing, and he's playing golf, and it's young. He's young. The game is fresh. There's no expectation really on his shoulders, and he's in a wonderful stage. That's not always going to happen. It's going to increase now. There's going to be more expectation on him when he goes to tournaments. As he moves on into life, life's going to get in the way in terms of, you know, he's sure he's maybe one day going to settle down. He's a long-term girlfriend. If he's going to settle down, maybe have kids, maybe business interests come. You know, will where he's at the moment, that interview he just gave now, that's the sweet spot. You know, it would be interesting to hear his interview in 5 years' time. Does he still see the game in the same way? Does he still have the freshness about competition? Does he still have the freshness and love for the game that he did then? Because the chances are probably not, because not many of the guys do. And at this moment in time, he's in the sweet spot. So I think it's too early to say. He certainly has all the potential, but you could say that about a number of guys. The guys that you mentioned there, they all have the same potential. And so much of it is going to come down to that hunger. And how long is that hunger going to last for? And how long is that... intention of being selfish and being it all about you, how long is that going to last for before other things come in and maybe contaminate that mindset? And you know, if you want to be ruthless about serial winners, that's the way they are. That's the way they see it. It's about being ruthless and about being very selfish in terms of their own careers.
Which brings us on to Tiger Woods. I mean, he managed it for so long, and he would have been within his rights, I think, in the last few years to say, do you know what, I've had a great run, I'm done. So final round 64, his lowest ever in a final round of a major, which was extraordinary. He didn't hit a fairway till the 10th.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it all right. I was watching it on my iPad. And I watched it. His iron play was superb. I mean, Absolutely fantastic. I think the golf course was not the most challenging, but it was the same for everybody. His putting looked fabulous. It was the first time. What we've seen a lot from Tiger this year so far is there was always something missing. This week, it was probably his driving. Not so much his driver, but he seemed to miss a lot of fairways with three woods and irons. When he hit a few drivers in the back nine area and he got in the middle of competition, he started to stripe it down the middle of the fairway, and that showed a real competitive edge, something that we really haven't seen when he's been in contention so far tournaments this year. So if you look at his path and what his graph of his performances, you know, he got in contention very early in the year when Paul Casey won, and he played the last hole one shot behind, like he was trying to protect second place. He hit an iron off the tee, he hit 195 yards in odd to a pin position that was impossible. I think Patrick Reed went with a wedge a couple of groups earlier, and he said, oh, God, that's not like Tiger. That's not like the competitive Tiger we know about. But this time, this was different. This was a guy who got the bit between his teeth. He saw where the leader was and kept stepping it up. He made the odd mistake, but he kept coming back, making birdies, and kept grinding it out. So this was the closest we've seen to the old Tiger.
You've seen it all, and you've done a lot of things in the game as well. But that stretch where 12 through to 15, where he went birdie, the bogey on 14, and then came back on 15, 164 yards, that 9-iron, when that landed on the green, I mean, like for an entire generation, they've never had that moment. And like the crowd couldn't, like crowd lost its mind. It was absolutely phenomenal. Like he does just bring something to golf that very, very few, pretty much no one can bring.
He does. He has a charisma. Listen, we all know about that. We've all seen it. But the other thing about it going on is everybody loves a comeback too. You know, Hollywood is built on comebacks, and everybody loves the old story of, you know, the Rocky story of the guy coming back from being on the canvas and being down and out and out. And that's pretty much where Tiger was. So there's that emotional aspect to it that everybody can relate to. You know, we've all had ups and downs in our lives, and we can all relate to coming back from the places that we know, you know, that he's been in terms of, you know, everything was going wrong in his life. He was having a really bad time off the golf course as well as on it with his injuries. And to see him coming back, of course, everybody can feel that sense of emotion because we've all had ups and downs in life.
How does his swing look? Like, you know, the issues off the tee in particular?
Well, to me, it looks fabulous. I mean, it's never looked anything that hasn't been fabulous to me. I mean, I'm not an expert in terms of what the golf swing is, but I like the flow of it. I think he just gets a little bit quick. I still think there's a bit of fear in there, but he's always played with a bit of fear in this game, and fear is not, it's not succumbing to fear is the king, and being able to be resilient and coming back from a mistake and being able to grind out like a par on 17 when, you know, he obviously had that fear of don't hit it in the water, and what does he do? He hits it in the water, but he still ground out a par. And you know, that's golf, you know. I mean, one of the big things we talk about that, you know, we talked earlier about the mindset that golfers have, and that ability to forget, that to have that goldfish kind of mind where by the time you go around the other side of the bowl, you've forgotten what happened the first time you were around. That's absolutely priceless when it comes to the mindset of a golfer. And to be able to forget about one shot and move on to the next one. That's what all the greats have talked about. That's what all the greats have talked about when they're in the zone, when they're in the mindset of winning major championships. And Tiger knows how that feels, and it's about reconnecting with those feelings. And he showed a lot of it, I have to say, yesterday. He surprised me how good he was yesterday. That really was a step up. Because when he got in contention in the Open Championship, you know, he made mistakes straight away.
Yeah.
The minute he got the lead, he made mistakes, and he got out of contention. It was like, oh, this I'm uncomfortable here. But this time he didn't. Mm. This time he kept trying to hunt down Koepka.
Yeah, which suggests maybe the resilience is growing, is becoming accustomed to it again. And do you hold out pretty big hopes now that come 2019 he's going to be there or thereabouts and actually can win a major again?
I think there's no doubt about that now. I think we've seen enough evidence now. And as I say, it's been a graph. It's been an upward graph from that first time in contention. First of all, coming back out in Bahamas last year with a ball speed of over 180 mile an hour, which you need to have really to contend at the top level week after week. He had that. Wow, that was a surprise to everybody. Then he goes out and he performs well in that tournament we talked about in Valspar, I think it was, where Casey won. And then he started having performances. And okay, it wasn't all coming together, but there was evidence there. Then he lost his putting. Then he got his putting back. Then he started to perform at the Open Championship, and now he's performed to another level again. So there's no doubt that you would have to think that, yes, he's got a great chance of winning certainly another major championship and certainly another tournament. And the interesting thing to look at is you know, that resilience. That's the thing that really impressed me. That was the old Tiger.
Yeah.
That was making a mistake and getting on with the next shot. Because he's never really been a great driver of the golf ball. He's always made mistakes, and he seemed to have that bit between his teeth from a competitive edge.
Yeah.
And that's what was most impressive. But the thing to remember as well, though, too, it's a different environment. It's a different world than it was 10 years ago when he was dominating the game. You know, you've got arguably three players at the moment in Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson, and Justin Thomas, who have got huge confidence, all three of them, can play the game as powerful, and if not more powerful than Tiger can. Now, when Tiger was at his best, he had another gear. He had another gear that the other guys couldn't go to, and he knew that. This is a different challenge for Tiger because he's got three or four guys ahead of him that he knows have got a different gear than he can go to. Mm. So he's got to box clever. He's got to find a different way of competing against them, and it's going to be interesting to see how he's going to go about that.
Clock coming against us now, so two last quick ones. Shane Lowry finished 12th, and so he's up to 139 on the FedEx, needs to get to 125. He's got the Wyndham Championship now, needs to move up another 14 places, so needs another really good week, but certainly his form has started trending in the right direction. From the outside, I mean, the only obvious difference is the change of caddy. It's kind of an amazing thing. Like, he had great success with Dermot, and then, I don't know, these things can grow stale, presumably.
You can, absolutely. Dermot's a fabulous caddy, one of the best caddies in the world, and he'll have no trouble getting another job should he want it. And it happens, it goes stale. And I think Shane is very much an Irishman. Of all of us, he's probably the most Irish of all of us in terms of he loves home comforts, he loves everything about Ireland. And I think the fact that his family are around him, his brother's caddying for him, I think has had a big effect on him, and it's reconnected him with when he plays his best golf. And when Shane is happy, that's the most important thing for Shane. He doesn't really lose it technically. He just comes in and out of love of the game. And when he has that little bit of sparkle in his eye, that's when he's at his most dangerous.
Mm. Finally then, Rory. So fifth at the Masters, missed the cut at the US Open, tied for second at the Open, and was well down the field over the weekend. His quotes afterwards, pretty interesting, Paul. There's a lot of room for improvement. My swing hasn't been where I want it to be. It was pretty good at the start of the year, but it sort of regressed as the season has went on. You start to fall back into habits you don't want to. He found three water hazards yesterday. He hit just four fairways in the final round. He was 77th driving accuracy, which isn't like him, 45th putting. And still the wedges continue to be a problem. He's talking about taking a couple of weeks off, trying to just put this thing together for Ryder Cup time. Very difficult for him at the moment. Did you see any real change in his wedge play? I know you talked about that on the show a while back. And I know maybe just in an overall kind of picture, you're talking about that desire, that fight that Rory maybe needs to get back to the 2014 level. There's something missing still. Whatever the missing piece of the jigsaw is, it's hard to tell from this distance.
Yeah, well, I mean, overall, golf is a simple game in very many ways. And yes, it's important to hit the ball a long way and drive it. But you've got to have the scoring clubs. You've got to be absolutely fantastic with the scoring clubs. Look at Dustin Johnson, how good he is with his wedges. Brooks Koepka with his putter. I mean, Justin Thomas the same. These guys are fabulous, absolutely fabulous. And Rory's always, he's only average. And sometimes the putting is good, like it was in Firestone a few weeks ago, but the wedge play is not great. Then the wedge play is not so bad, and then the putting's off. And those scoring clubs are absolutely paramount for a start. Yeah. And the other thing is, and I think we all need to take a step away and realize that Rory's not, you know, this perception that Rory plays his best, he wins. That's not applicable anymore. You know, there's three guys at the moment who you'd have to say are better players than Rory if they're on the game. Brooks Koepka, Justin Thomas, and Dustin Johnson. They have that extra gear that Rory used to have. Like we talked about, Tiger, you know, has to box clever. Rory has to now box clever. He's coming up to 30 years of age. Mm. He's got three guys who hit the ball just as far, just as straight as him, just as got as much ability under pressure to perform as Rory has had. And it's a while since Rory's won his last major championship. So now it's about, okay, these guys can now play the game. I used to have an advantage over them. Now I don't. So I got to box clever. And by boxing clever is my distance control needs to be as good as theirs. And I need to get into a tight situation because I know I can compete against those guys. And that's the future for Rory. He doesn't have that extra gear where he can just rely on, oh, my talent will get me through in the end, because those guys have really stepped up in the last 4 years. And that, more than anything else, not alone is it a reason why they're winning and Rory necessarily hasn't, but also psychologically it's having an effect on Rory as well too. You know, he doesn't have that extra gear that the others did. So, as I say, this is why I keep saying, you know, Rory has to reassess and about how he's going to approach the game going forward, because the goalposts have moved. He's not no longer the lone talented guy ahead of everybody else. There's now other guys that are up there with him, and some maybe even ahead of him.
That's fascinating. I hadn't realised, because you still hear, and actually I'll let you go now because the clock's against us, you still hear the line trotted out that when Rory plays his best, he'll win. It's interesting you feel that has kind of, we've transitioned slightly out of that now, and that must be difficult for him.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. I think the evidence suggests it, Joe, and to suggest otherwise is not fair or not right. If you want to be cold and analytical about it, these guys can play. Look how good Brooks Koepka, look how resilient he was in the US Open, and look how good he was from tee to green this week. You know, Rory at his best, could he have taken him down? Could he have taken him down? I don't know. We don't know. I think 4 years ago we would have said yes, or 3 years ago Rory at his best will win. But I certainly don't think at the moment that Rory can rely on his talent to get him over the line anymore, because these guys have really stepped up against him. And I think that puts a lot of expectation on Rory's shoulder, where everybody expects him to win all the time. And we don't realize how good the competition is out there, and how good these guys are, and how hungry these guys are, and also what a different stage in their life these guys are. Mm. You know, the guys we talk about are not married, or you know, they're early in their careers, and they've got that appetite and that hunger that Rory had 4 years ago. Now, when that appetite wanes a little bit, that doesn't mean it just shut off and you don't be successful. You know, look how long you know, guys like Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus kept going. But golf is a very tough game, and it wears you down. It wears you down physically, it wears you down mentally. Life gets in the way, and you've got to have a very, very clear head and a clear desire to play golf for such a sustained period of time. And that's why there's so few who have won, for example, the Grand Slam of all four major championships and have longevity in the game, because it's so difficult. There's always a new kid in the block coming along.
Listen, brilliant stuff. Thanks so much for your time. Much appreciated.
All right, you're welcome. Thank you.
And then this week we've got the Wyndham Championship. So Shane Lowry goes there really trying to save his card. That is the plan. Seamus Power as well, obviously, playing and doing slightly better. But Shane Lowry kind of up to 139 after his tied 12th at the USPGA. So we caught up with Shane on Tuesday. And at that stage, I think he was just arriving onto the course. And I was like, so where are you? You're somewhere in North Carolina, Shane.
I am, Joe. Yeah, I just arrived at the golf club. So here in Greensboro.
You sound excited.
Very excited.
I guess you must be a bit tired. I mean, what a roller coaster couple of weeks, and not least, sometime around the 12th and 13th on Sunday at Bellerive when you go birdie-birdie and you're right in the teeth of that championship. What an amazing couple of days.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, like, I know I didn't have the finish that I really would have wanted, but looking back and it was one of the best days on the golf course I've ever had. I mean, it's hard to describe what it was like out there because it was such mayhem and, you know, the crowds, and every time Tiger made a birdie, it was just crazy. And yeah, it was just, you know, to make those two birdies on 12 and 13, and I really felt like I was in the mix going down 14. And yeah, it was it was an interesting day. It was great though.
The crowds came across on TV, actually. They did look different to a lot of weeks. And you mentioned, like, they go wild every time Tiger makes a birdie. He made 8 of them. So you must be really conscious he's doing something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably the biggest crowd I've ever seen on the golf course, apart from that tournament in Phoenix. But it was different than that. It was just, like I said, hard to describe. And, like, yeah, every time Tiger made a birdie, like when we were on the 11th, Justin Thomas had about an 8-footer to go into the lane, and they changed the scoreboard just before he hit his putt, and the crowd literally erupted, and he had to back off his putt for about 2 minutes because they just wouldn't stop cheering. And then he rolled it in afterwards as well. It was one of the maddest things I've ever seen.
Does that get you buzzed up? Does that get you sharp? Does that get you focused? Like, did you love it?
Yeah, like, to be honest, the whole day goes very quick when you're out there. You're just kind of on autopilot and trying to do everything as slow as I can and as deliberate as I can, to, you know, to stay in the moment or whatever. But you're kind of trying to take it all in as well, because I mean, like, it's such a special place to be as well, and I'm lucky to be there. And you know, I enjoyed it as much as I could.
Yeah, 100%. I guess you're probably turning to your brother on the bag and saying, it's not usually like this. You're getting a good week here, buddy. Yeah. Enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we were in Reno the week before, and it was two men and a dog out watching. So it was a bit different. And we had a great time. And we finished after a round, and Alan, we're sitting in the locker room, and Alan said, like, that was one of the maddest experiences of his life. It was one of those days where, you know, you'll always kind of remember and talk about.
I've no doubt. And I saw on Instagram you said your dad was walking the fairways with you. So that's going to be a good Christmas memory when you're all sitting around the table. What an amazing thing for you to have him walking alongside you as well.
He actually wasn't supposed to come. And then when Alan was kind of caddy for me, we said, like I said to him, you might as well come over because it might never happen again or whatever. Mm. And then we just had such a good week, the three of us together. And you know, to be in there with a show on Sunday and have him there. He was obviously one of the proudest men out there, and, you know, he loved every minute of it as well. And, you know, we had a great week all around. Obviously, I still, you know, even though it was a great week, I still think it was, you know, a little bit disappointing with the finish. But look, I really enjoyed it, and I have a lot of positives to take from it as well.
Yeah, no doubt. You talked there about trying to slow things down in the midst of all the mayhem. I mean, it was slowed down for you quite a bit in 16. There were some rule officials lacking some balls, I think was the quote. That was a bit of a mess, really. You don't expect that to happen at a major. Your only option was to drop near a tree from the hospitality, and then in the end, it seemed you just said, sod this, I'm going to play from where I was.
Yeah, that's kind of what I said in the end. And, like, I believe I seen afterwards that the CBS guys were giving me a bit of stick for holding up Justin Thomas.
They were, yeah.
And I'm not sure they realised I was actually playing the tournament as well, but yeah, look, I mean, it was a bit of a mess, to be honest. And I still think when I talked about it afterwards and talked about it to a couple of people, I should have got relief and I would have had an easier chip. Now, I'm not saying I definitely would have made par, but I did make a great open iron for bogey. If I had my double there, I think it would have been a lot different and I would have had a lot more to say. But it was kind of a spot where I was going to struggle to make par anyway. But if I had got my drop, I probably would have had a good chance at it as opposed to having to open iron for bogey. But look, I said what I said afterwards and I stick to it. I think, like I said, they didn't man up and they didn't make the decision and that's what they're there to do. And I mean, it was just a bit of a, you know, it wasn't nice and, you know, we had to wait around. Obviously, Justin had to wait around. And,
to be fair, he came out.
I was asked afterwards, was there any beef between us for what happened? I was like, why would that be? But,
That was the TV almost painting that picture because the CBS lads were like, geez, poor Justin here. Shane Lowry's really holding him up. That was the way they were almost presenting it to the audience. Yeah. But Thomas came out afterwards and totally said the rules officials dilly-dallied a bit there. They actually weren't making a decision.
Yeah, that's what they just wouldn't make a decision. And it was weird. It was probably, I was looking back and it's the weirdest thing that's probably happened to me where we were like, I spoke to Porrick afterwards, and anyone who knows Porrick knows that he knows the rules. And he said, if he was there, he would have got the drop in the story. And that's kind of, that's the way it was. And, you know, I should have been firmer with them and I should have called for someone else. But at the end of the day, I just wanted to get on with it and I just wanted to finish my round. And, maybe I was a bit silly playing on. I should have waited.
Maybe, yeah. I guess it's tough. You want to keep some kind of rhythm, I presume, in those scenarios. So the net result, tied for 12th. The pity about those two bogeys at the end. But the bigger picture is that you're kind of really chasing your card now and you've put together a great few weeks. So you're up to kind of 139 on the FedEx. You ideally want to get into 125. So you're at Greensboro this week. Jeez, you're not doing it the easy way. But
no.
A kind of a top five, top 10 finish gives you a real chance. It's a kind of complicated system, but you're kind of up against it again this week. But clearly you feel like your golf's suddenly come round. Is there any reason? Because like the last big quote we saw from you was maybe British Open, where, you know, all the headlines about, well, I'm not loving golf right now and golf doesn't love me. And obviously you ended things with Dermot around that time as well. And that was a great partnership for so long. What's the upswing? How do you explain it?
Like obviously the last 3 weeks have been very good and I've finished, you know, I've top 15 in the last three events and I've contended at certain stages of each weekend. And look, I don't know 100% what the answer is or what it was, but like having Alan on the bag obviously freshens it up a little bit, puts a lot more onus on myself and I think that has a little bit to do with it, but I'm slow enough to say that because Dermot was great to me for so long. And, you know, we had 9 years together, 9 successful years. And, you know, it was kind of hard to finish that. And it was hard to kind of, it's almost like breaking up a marriage, you know, because it was going on for so long. And, but yeah, look, it could be that bit of freshness that I needed or something. And, like you say, I'm here at Wyndham this week now. I need a top 5 to keep my card over here. But look, no matter what happens this week, it's been a good few weeks. And I go home, albeit hopefully not next week. Hopefully we're going to New York to play in the first week of the FedEx Cup. But if I'm not, it'll be a successful 4 weeks. And I've found my form. I found a bit of confidence again, which is huge. Like I was seriously lacking confidence for most part of the season. And you know, the last 3 weeks have been the first 3 weeks really where I haven't been sitting on the cut mark on Friday afternoon, and it's a lot easier to play golf when you're not on the cut mark. It's a lot easier to make birdies and hit good shots, and you're not trying to steer it around and make pars and try and make the course. And look, I'll go out and give my best this week and see what happens.
Yeah, I can only imagine how difficult it is to play that sport at that level with not much confidence. It must be lovely to have it back. And one last one on Dermot. You talked there about, like, it is like a marriage and you had great years together. The moment of having to say to him, look, I think we kind of need to leave this or park this, I'd say that was horrific. And you knowing you were about to do it for maybe a few days or a few weeks, unbelievably stressful thing, you know, on top of everything else.
Yeah, look, it was. And it was probably one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do. So that's kind of all I'm going to say about it. I'm not going to dive into it too much because, you know, I'm conscious of him and whatever, but it was one of the most difficult things that's ever had to happen. And it's funny, he's working for Julian Surrey for a couple of weeks and we're very nearly paired with him on Sunday, so that would have been interesting. But look, it is what it is. We spoke a little bit last week, and we flew down. We were on a charter flight down here to Wyndham, and we sat beside each other on the plane and stuff. So we're still good friends, and you know, he's been very good to me, and I've been good to him. So that's kind of the way we've left it.
Ah, that's brilliant. Because lots of caddy players, when that moment comes, they can't look at each other for a while. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So that's the way we wanted to leave it. We spoke about it at the Open, and we wanted to leave it where we'd still remain friends, because we've had, like we said, 9 successful years together.
Yeah. Listen, I won't keep, because I know I'd say you're a bit tired, and I'd say it's a busy week, and I think you're going to have to practice now. So listen, the very best of luck. Hopefully the good form continues, and we'll talk to you when we talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Joe.
There you are, Shane Lowry speaking to us. So, Claude Harmon, Shane Lowry, Paul McGinley, that is our pod for this week. We'll be back next week, hopefully. Talk to you then. Good luck. All my exes wear Rolex, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket town. Little J.D. Starter kid right here.